This is Ann Weller with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And during the next 30 minutes, I will be sharing nutrition information with you. This information is selected from the Nutrition Action Health Letter, a publication of the Center for Science in the Public Interest, based in Washington, D.C. The Center for Science in the Public Interest was founded in 1971 by three scientists who wanted to apply their academic training to the solving of social problems. It conducts innovative research and other programs in health and nutrition. And the center provides consumers with current information about their health and well-being. An independent, nonprofit consumer health group, the center promotes honest food labeling and advertising, safer and more nutritious foods, and pro-health alcohol policies. The work of the Center for Science in the Public Interest is supported by Nutrition Action Health Letter subscribers and by foundation grants. It accepts no government or industry funding, and Nutrition Action Health Letter, which was first published in 1974, accepts no advertising. The following edition of Nutrition News is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Please use the information presented in this broadcast in consultation with your personal physician. With the right food choices, the right physical activity, and with not smoking, we could prevent about 80% of heart disease, about 90% of diabetes, and about 70% of stroke, says Walter Willett, chair of the nutrition department at the Harvard School of Public Health in Boston. Those are the three pillars, and they really do make a difference: the right food choices, physical activity, and not smoking. The right food choices are simple. Eat less red meat, fewer sweets, fewer refined grains, and less salt, and drink fewer sugary beverages. Replace unhealthy foods with vegetables, fruits, beans, and whole grains, and with smaller amounts of fish, poultry, and low-fat dairy food. Those foods are not just good for your health. They can also protect the earth. Here's why and how to eat real. Nutrition Action Health Letter Director of Nutrition, Bonnie Liebman, conducted a telephone interview with Dr. Willett, and the results of that interview are published in the cover story of the October 2011 issue of Nutrition Action Health Letter. Ms. Liebman begins the discussion by asking Dr. Willett if food can keep us healthy. Dr. Willett responds that the foods we choose have a huge impact on our long-term health and well-being. We have learned that in the last few decades. We have seen that, say, rates of heart disease in Northern Europe are 10 times higher than those in Southern Europe, and that rates of cancer vary tenfold or more around the world. The foods we choose, along with physical activity and not smoking, are a major factor in those huge differences in rates of almost every disease that we look at, including heart disease, stroke, diabetes, and many cancers. Within that healthy market basket will be mostly plant foods. That means plenty of vegetables, but not potatoes, and plenty of fruit, but not fruit juices. It is aiming more for the more intact, less processed fruits and vegetables, and for whole grains as opposed to refined grains. Those factors have an enormous influence. And I should add, healthy protein sources, which means a combination of plant-based foods like legumes and nuts, and a modest amount of poultry, fish, and dairy. It is not necessary to be a vegan, but to move in the direction of plant-based choices. But just aiming for a plant-based diet alone does not cut it. If your plant-based diet is high in refined starch and sugar, for example, that could be the worst possible diet. Now, cancer incidence is more complicated than heart disease, stroke, and diabetes. And it is pretty clear now that diet's biggest impact on cancer is in avoiding overweight and obesity. And they are almost entirely avoidable. Obviously, the quantity of food is important, and choosing the right foods can help us control our calories and our weight. It's the same market basket that's high in intact whole grains, fruits, and vegetables, and low in sugar, sugary beverages, refined grains, potatoes, and red meat, and low in salt. Yes, keeping salt on the low side is definitely important for preventing heart attacks and strokes. But that tends to happen automatically if you eat fruits, vegetables, and whole grains that have been minimally processed. You still need to pay attention because you can find whole grains even at places like Whole Foods that are extremely high in salt, even though they are marketed as healthy. If you go the processed, prepackaged route, you run the risk of a high salt intake. But if you prepare your own intact foods, most of the time your salt intake will be low. And why limit red meat? The evidence has now become very strong that keeping red meat low is one of the most important steps in creating a healthy diet. Replacing meat with almost anything is better, but replacing it with poultry will move you in the right direction, and replacing it with fish or nuts, something with positive health benefits, is even better. Red meat is high in unhealthy fats, and even lean cuts have unhealthy fats. So, replacing them with unsaturated fats will move the risk of heart disease and diabetes in the right direction. Now, we're not sure how red meat affects diabetes. There may be multiple factors in meat. Some evidence suggests that iron increases the risk of diabetes. The link with diabetes has not been appreciated until very recently, and now it's been seen in many studies. And meat promotes colon cancer, particularly if it's processed red meat. So much happens in the processing that we're not sure what matters, but the evidence is quite strong. Breast cancer does not seem to be related to red meat consumption during midlife and later. But we have seen a relationship with red meat consumed in early adult life and high school. So far, we have the only prospective data on high school diet and breast cancer, so that needs confirmation. So Ms. Liebman asks, how much red meat is okay? Dr. Willett responds, like almost everything, it's frequency and amount that influence our risk. There is no sharp cutoff. It's like radiation. We cannot say that there's any safe level. But the large majority of the risk would be removed if everyone would cut back from the current average intake, which is about once a day for red meat, to once or twice a week in a very moderate amount. For example, a 20-ounce steak once a week is still a lot of meat. And a serving should be 3 or 4 ounces cooked. That would be a huge step in the right direction for the vast majority of Americans who are eating red meat on a daily basis. Now, refined grains are problematic in two ways. Much of their vitamins and minerals and fiber are removed in the refining process. For example, there is pretty good evidence that the magnesium that's removed has some protective effect for diabetes and heart disease. Labels usually call the flour enriched, and in parentheses you'll see a list of vitamins that are added back, but it should be called depleted flour or depleted and partially restored flour. So you see, there's a problem with what is lost, but also with what is created, which is rapidly absorbed, high glycemic form of carbohydrate that has clear adverse effects on the risk of diabetes, weight gain, and heart disease. A high glycemic carbohydrate raises your blood sugar rapidly. The strongest evidence that glycemic index matters comes from the trial of a drug that inhibits an enzyme secreted by the intestine to split long-chain starches into their glucose-building blocks. And this drug inhibits that enzyme. So, in effect, it is turning a high glycemic index carb into a low glycemic index carb. The drug reduces the risk of heart disease and diabetes. From a physiological standpoint, it's the definitive study on glycemic index. No matter what your diet, if you switch from a higher to a lower glycemic index carbohydrate, you will get the expected drop in blood glucose. And that is why glycemic load matters. Because glycemic load takes into account the amount of carbohydrate as well as the glycemic index. Can you overdo whole grains? Well, you can always overdo foods. A key principle that has been documented in the last few decades is that if you are lean and active, you can tolerate more carbohydrate. If you are not lean and active, a high carbohydrate diet can exacerbate insulin resistance. What is interesting is that if you're really eating whole grains, you won't overeat. You won't overeat them. I think of my Kashi pilaf as a paradigm because it's a blend of intact grains. Now, I'm not talking about whole grain bread or Kashi breakfast cereals. I can only tolerate 30 to 40% of calories from intact grains because more than that causes gastrointestinal disturbances. So the healthiest whole grains are self-limiting. So what's wrong with sugars? At this point, sugary beverages are the number one problem in the American diet. They are the number one source of calories on average. Sugary beverages are also the number one sales item in terms of dollars in grocery stores. And a lot are consumed at McDonald's and other fast food places. Sugary beverages are like cigarette smoking. They are only bad, and they have no redeeming virtue. And the adverse effects are weight gain, diabetes, heart disease, gout, cavities, and maybe some cancers as well. Even fruit juice is a problem. It is associated with a higher risk of diabetes. And you would expect that because fruit juice has about the same number of calories per serving as Coke or Pepsi, and it will have the same metabolic effect. Some nutrients come along with fruit juice, but there's a big metabolic price to pay for getting nutrients that you could get from foods that have fewer calories. And most people are getting those nutrients anyway. So 2 glasses of orange juice a day does not have many health benefits, and it has many harms. So what benefits do fruits and vegetables provide? The benefit for lowering the risk of cardiovascular disease is clear. Some of that is due to their potassium, the potassium in fruits and vegetables, which lowers blood pressure. That is proven. But some is also likely due to their folic acid, antioxidants, and other micronutrients. Fruits and vegetables are a primary source of vitamins and many minerals. We do not understand all their benefits. There may be some modest benefit for preventing some cancers, but a large benefit is not there. So why do we need oils and nuts? Replacing saturated fat or carbohydrate with unsaturated fat definitively lowers LDL or bad cholesterol and triglycerides. And there's a huge amount of evidence that that will reduce the risk of heart attacks. It does seem that there's some added benefit of polyunsaturated fats above monounsaturated fats, but virtually all oils and nuts have some of both. But with 120 calories in a tablespoon of oil and about 175 calories in just a quarter cup of nuts, it's easy to go overboard. It becomes too much of a good thing. Eating a horrible diet and pouring oil on it is not a good idea. Just like sprinkling bran on a horrible diet is not a good idea. But if you consume nuts and oils as part of an overall healthy diet, it's easier to control calories. But that means replacing the bad stuff with good stuff. And good foods can taste good. Putting good foods together and preparing them well can make a way of eating that's a pleasure, not a sacrifice. In fact, it is more interesting, enjoyable, and varied than the mainstream American diet. In another interview, Nutrition Action Health Letter senior nutritionist David Shart spoke with Robert Lawrence about the impact of food production on the environment. Dr. Lawrence is the founding director of the Center for a Livable Future at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health in Baltimore. So how does the way we produce our food affect the environment? Dr. Lawrence responds that the most important impact of the industrialization of agriculture in North America is the progressive consolidation and concentration in the way we raise animals for human consumption. In the United States, we now produce 9 billion animals for food every year. Now that includes about 100 million hogs, 35 million head of cattle, and slightly more than 8 billion broiler chickens. That's 1 million broilers per hour 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. And raising animals this way degrades our environment and consumes our resources. It also provides much of our protein, but in a very inefficient way. It takes about 7 pounds of grain to produce 1 pound of beef, and about 6.5 pounds of grain to produce a pound of pork. Even poultry, which is the most efficient animal, requires about 2.6 pounds of grain to produce 1 pound of meat. And how does that tax our resources? Well, it contributes to the growing scarcity of water, for one thing. To grow the grain to produce 1 pound of beef requires 840 gallons of water, and that is clearly not sustainable. Water tables throughout the country are declining. Another adverse effect of our food production is the concentration of animal waste. Our industrial agricultural system produces about 1 ton of animal waste solids. That is, what is left of their excrement after the water has been removed. 1 ton of animal waste solids for every single person in this country. And that is 40 times as much waste as humans produce. Animal waste, which was once a rich source of organic fertilizer, has now become a major polluter of our surface water, soil, and air. And how has our emphasis on producing meat affected farming? Well, we've lost diversity because of the large concentrations of row crops, particularly corn and soybeans, that feed the animals that we eat. In one example, in the mid-1950s, there were more than 25 different commodities, things like potatoes, cherries, popcorn, oats, and plums, that were commercially viable in Iowa, meaning that they were grown in Iowa and either sold within the state or shipped out of state. Today, Iowa is reduced to essentially four: corn, soybeans, hogs, and cattle. And that increases the need for long-distance transportation. It means, for example, that the grain grown in the Midwest is shipped 1,000 miles to the eastern shore of Maryland to feed the 500 to 600 million broilers that are produced on the Delmarva Peninsula each year. And that requires more energy. And not just for transportation. We've also come to rely more and more on fossil fuels to produce synthetic fertilizers, pesticides, and herbicides. The net effect is that we have compromised the resilience of our food system. Our heavy dependence on fossil fuels puts our nation at risk as the cost of energy goes up and the cost of food follows. The U.S. Department of Agriculture estimates the average adult American male consumes about 70% more protein every day than he needs. That's 70%. And for women, it's about 25% more. And what's more, 67% of the dietary protein in the North American diet comes from animal sources, compared to a worldwide average of about 30%. More than double. So not only are we eating more protein than we need, but we are eating more of our protein in the form of meat protein, as opposed to high-quality vegetable protein. Reducing the amount of beef, pork, and poultry that we consume would immediately ease our footprint on the environment. And that is a very tough message to sell to people. Because culturally we have developed this taste for meat. And our biological evolution probably prepared us to enjoy eating fatty foods. Now the Meatless Monday campaign, which began in 2003, is a movement to cut meat consumption by going one day a week without eating meat. Its goal is to improve the health of people and the planet. The Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins University, where I work, has been the campaign's technical and scientific advisor since its beginning. What inspired Meatless Mondays? Well, one of the objectives of the Surgeon General's Healthy People Goals for the decade 2000 to 2010 was to reduce the saturated fat in the American diet by 15%. And we thought that even a skilled nutritionist would have a difficult time figuring out how to cut back saturated fat by 15% over the 21 meals in a week. And it turns out that one day is about 15% of the week. So since the biggest source of saturated fat in the U.S. diet is meat, Americans could go far toward meeting the Surgeon General's recommendation by going one day a week without meat. You would also have to include one day a week without cheese and whole milk dairy products, because they are the other major sources of saturated fat. But for simplicity's sake, we focused on the Meatless Monday concept. We picked Monday because studies suggest that people are more likely to stick with changes in behavior if they begin them on Monday. What can people do beyond eating less meat? Dr. Lawrence suggests that they can buy more locally grown foods, which helps decrease our reliance on long-distance transportation and the fossil fuels that transportation requires. Locally produced foods are available at farmers' markets, which are increasing dramatically in number. The food industry has used our evolutionary preference for fat and sugar very effectively by formulating processed foods that are high in fats, sugars, and salt. And it takes a conscious effort to stay on the perimeter of the supermarket, where the fresh fruits and vegetables and the dairy products and the whole foods are, and to avoid the center of the store, where the highly processed foods are displayed. Well, folks, we've reached the conclusion of this month's segment of Nutrition News. The show will be rebroadcast this week on Friday at 11 p.m. and on Saturday at 3 p.m. Please join me for the next edition of Nutrition News, which will air on Wednesday, December 7th. I'm Ann Weller, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and I hope that you have enjoyed the show. The program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long till next month.